Welcome to another edition of El Paso Primetime. I'm Dennis Wu. And this afternoon, we get to speak to a couple of great experts about some pretty interesting things. And oh, by the way, happy Pi Day. You know, with all the advancements of technology and whatnot, it still boggles the mind that the Malaysian airliner 370 is still missing to this day. David Soucy is our guest this afternoon on El Paso Primetime, and we are on the one-year anniversary of the tragedy. The Malaysian airliner, Flight 370, what happened to it, we don't exactly know. But David Soucy is on the line with us. He is a CNN advisor, a flight advisor. His new book is out, and it's quite a telling story. The title of the book, Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, Why It Disappeared and Why It's Only a Matter of Time Before This Happens Again. And it's on Skyhorse Publishing. Congratulations, first off, on the creation of this new book.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
One of the things that we need to get to right off the bat is, after a year, where are we now in trying to find 370?
Well, the search I say we because I feel like I've been part of it from the beginning, I suppose, but the Australians and Malaysians have continued the search with some very sophisticated and expensive equipment. They've covered about 9,000 square miles so far. There's another 18,000 square miles that they'll be searching in order to find anything, but so far they've yielded nothing. There's not one sign of this aircraft, not a floating cushion, not a anything on the bottom of the ocean, absolutely nothing.
It fuels a lot of speculation from mainstream audiences who buy into the notion and the idea of conspiracy theories. And your mm-hmm. book does address that as well. But I think at least here on the border, people keep saying that this plane was probably hijacked and taken to Kazakhstan.
And I'll tell you what, there's a lot of people that feel that way. And in the analysis that I did, I use an algorithm that I've used for about 20 years on aircraft accidents and searches. And this algorithm weighs the information or the clues that we have against themselves to see what's the most probable explanation for what's going on. There were only about 125 clues. Now, in other accident investigations, I've had as many as, 10 or 12,000 clues that we weigh against each other. So this is very unique, and it doesn't give us anything very conclusive. The difference between the aircraft being commandeered and the numbers for some other in-flight failure or fire, they were very close, or much closer than I would normally expect to see. However, the confidence I have in the Inmarsat data, the satellite connections or the pings that we talked about, those have me convinced now that the aircraft is out in the middle of the Indian Ocean and that it wasn't a situation of commandeering the aircraft for later use against us.
There's a new article out in Associated Press, and basically it's an article that looks at better tracking for these airliners, not just the airlines, but the airliners themselves trying to retrofit. It would be an expensive proposition, but certainly loss of human life versus $100,000 retrofit. I don't know. That seems like there's no comparison.
There is, and let's put it into perspective. To be able to watch television on an aircraft carrier, on an aircraft of this type, costs about between $100,000 and $500,000 to put on each and every aircraft. That's a lot of money, mm-hmm. and they make up for that by saying, "Well, we'll put in $5 charges." So, if it were me, and it is me when I fly, I would like to say I could put in $10 and have automatic straight flight following that follows me wherever I go on the planet. Wouldn't that be worth $10 to you? It sure would be to me.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I'll give up
the movie for that.
There you go. We can track our cell phones. I think we should be able to track an airliner.
Absolutely. Now, the environment's different. A lot of people make that cell phone comparison, but I choose not to because, a lot of us have done transoceanic flights. A lot of us have been on a cruise ship, for example, across the ocean. That is vast, and you're hundreds, sometimes thousands and thousands of miles from any kind of landmass that would be able to have an antenna or anything. So we're really relying on a satellite connection, and your cell phones do not make satellite connections. that's a misconception when you say your GPS is working. Mm-hmm. What it's really doing is triangulating between the cell towers around. Sometimes they can make those satellite connections, but that's a specialized cell phone or telephone that has a lot different technology and much more expensive technology than we have on our cell phones.
Your book really does detail, I mean, piece to piece to piece exactly what happened to this airline and to the point when it disappeared. And one of the things that captivates me are how you discuss the ULBs, the underwater locator beacons. I think that's a crucial thing because those batteries go away.
They do. And what exacerbates this problem of the 30-day batteries is the fact that that we've known about this for a long time. It's been a problem with accident investigations for many years. The Air France 447 accident, that was a recommendation from the French Civil Aviation Authority to say, look, we have to increase the time that these batteries transmit their signal, because if you recall, we searched for the underwater locator beacons and the black boxes on that aircraft for 2 years before they were finally located, and they were located just by happenstance, really. They really, Dave Gallo up at the underwater research laboratory that found this at Woods Hole, they said that it was just a matter of pure luck that they happened to go over it with a camera and see that there was, I think that's a black box. And they found it, you know, after 2 years of searching. So it was pure luck to have found it. So when they made the recommendation to increase it to 90 days, the battery's life on these things, you would think that'd be simple. Let's get it done. And it took several years, 3 or 4 years, to say, yeah, we're going to increase them to 90 days. But here's where the problem was. There wasn't any enforcement to say, let's retroactively do it. So it left 25,000 air carriers out there still flying with 30-day batteries on these black boxes, and only had to replace them when they failed or when they had to be replaced by newer aircraft or newer batteries at all. So that was wrong. It needed to be done. That's only one of 3 or 4 different things that I mentioned in my book that really need to be done, and we haven't had the enforcement capability or the wherewithal to make that happen and to get it done.
The International Civil Aviation Organization set out a few guidelines in order to try to get airlines to buy into at least pinging 15 minutes, every 15 minutes, where they are with satellite tracking and all of that. Do you agree 15 minutes is enough, or shouldn't it be a lot more?
Well, 15 minutes is enough if you complement it with another technology. Let me explain that a little bit.
Okay.
Every 15 minutes, you'd be able to tell, well, how far does an aircraft go in 15 minutes? A long way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're talking about 100 miles or more. So now remember, in Air France 447, we knew where that aircraft was. Within 5 square miles, we knew where that aircraft went into the water. Yet it took 2 years to find it. So again, that 15 minutes is helpful. It's good, but there needs to be more. What we don't have is a real-time emergency locating transmitter that goes off and tells us exactly where the aircraft is. That's not expensive technology. That's not something we need to make major changes to do either. Currently, the emergency locator transmitters on the airplane are made for severe impacts into land. If they go into the water, once they go underwater, they serve no purpose at all. So what my push is to say is, let's get emergency locator transmitters that actually locate aircraft. What a concept would that be? Because when they're in the water, they need what they call an emergency position indicator radio beacon, which every ship that does transoceanic travel right now, every boat has to have that on there. And when that ship sinks, when it goes into the water, within minutes, sometimes seconds, the satellites, there's 17 satellites around the globe that are looking for this signal, this 406 megahertz signal, and once they get it, they can triangulate into that position within seconds and say, this is exactly within yards where that beacon is transmitting from. And that's what we don't have on aircraft, and that is what we need.
David Soucy is our guest this afternoon on El Paso Primetime. His new book is out, called Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, Why It Disappeared and Why It's Only a Matter of Time Before This Happens Again. And in your book, you really go deep into the aviation industry, and you expose a lot of flaws that I think maybe mainstream aviation people don't want to admit, and the other side of the equation, all of the passengers don't know that they're there.
Well, and that's very true. And, you know, I hate to go too bad against the FAA or against the regulatory authorities because of the fact that we truly live in a time when being in the air is safer than flying or than driving around in your car. So, but that's not where you stop. There's still, you know, I face the families. I talk to the families of accidents and of accident victims, and it's incredibly painful. One of the analogies I like to use is people think they're safe in airplanes, and they are. They really are. Mm-hmm. If you're the million to one guy and you say, hey, it's a million to one chance I'm going to die in an airplane, so I'm fine with that. I'm good to go. But what if I was to tell you that you are the one and not the million? It kind of changes your perspective on these statistics and things like that. You are safe on an airplane, but there are things you can do to be safer, and you are part of that safety system in a lot of ways. Namely, when you're on board the aircraft and you just go on and you say, you become complacent to everything around you, and there are case after case of accidents or fires on board, things like that that are on the ground that were brought to the attention of the flight crew and saved lives. I mean, passengers can save other passengers' lives, but you have to be cognizant. You have to be aware of your surroundings, talk to the people next to you, and be educated and knowledgeable about what you're doing. And that's a responsibility that flyers have for other flyers, and it's often ignored.
Yeah. One of the things that I'm noting here in your timeline is about that transponder that failed at 1:21 in the morning. And it didn't talk to the radar like it was supposed to. And it also disappeared from that Thai military radar screen, too, right?
Yeah, it did. And there's a lot of lessons have been learned from this. Even though there's no aircraft found and we don't know what caused the initial problem, what we have done is there has been so much advancement. If you just a brief stroll down a different story here at 9/11, when that occurred, our military radar did not talk to the civilian radar folks, so they really had a hard time saying, hey, this airplane's left. Well, is it a military action? Is it a civilian action? We don't know what it is. That they never really communicated with each other very well. Today, they're sitting side by side. You look at a military air traffic controller and you look at a civilian air traffic controller, they're literally sharing shoulders, working together. That did not happen over in Asia. The aircraft disappeared. While the aircraft was disappearing, the civilian radar was looking for it. Those are the folks that were looking for it on their radar screens and couldn't find it because that secondary transponder wasn't responding. The military was over there in Thailand saying, oh, there's an airplane right there. There it goes. Yep, it's not a military threat, so it's not a concern of ours. Nothing to concern ourselves with. They had no idea that had they reported that right away, we probably would have a much better idea as to where this airplane is right now, because we wouldn't have lost the first 4 to 8 hours of critical search time.
And one last question before I let you go, because there are so many questions, and I'd love to have you back. But this one thing that really kind of bothers me is if there was a catastrophic electrical failure on board this aircraft, how could that happen if there is supposed to be redundancy within the aircraft to keep vital signs alive?
Oh, that's a great question. Triple redundancy is something that is actually a mandated regulation with manufacturing aircraft of this size. So you would think, hey, if this radio fails, the other one does as well. What wasn't considered in this, and there's many cases, I wish we had more time to go into it, but is the fact that everything that is triple redundant is co-located. So the one thing that isn't redundant is where they're located on the aircraft. So all of the radios, the ACARS system, which sends out information about the aircraft through the SATCOM, the transponders, the VHF radios, the ADS-B, all of the radios that stopped working simultaneously are all co-located within about 2 feet of each other. And therein lies the most probable explanation for how they all went off at the same time. Because to turn them off manually, they get turned off from different locations in the aircraft. You'd have to be in the emergency or in the electronics bay to turn some of them off. You have to be up in the cockpit to turn others off. So it would have had to be an incredibly coordinated thing to be able to turn them all off simultaneously like that. Whereas the best explanation and the Occam's razor of all of this is to say that everything that failed was co-located in one specific area, and that area actually had a history of some fires on the 777. There was a fire in Egypt Air, which could have, if it was in the air when it occurred, it could have easily caused a rapid and explosive decompression, which would have explained so many things with this aircraft. So therein, I guess I've exposed the end of the book to everybody, darn it. But that's just such a small part of this, and the actual occurrence is only indicative and a symptom of a much larger problem, which is our regulatory system needs to be improved to be able to respond and provide the safety necessary to all of the travelers, no matter where we are in the world, that we enjoy here in the United States.
Domestically, are we safe?
I think internationally we're safe.
Okay.
Safe is such one of those terms that can't be defined.
Right.
I feel safe. I fly internationally all the time right now. There's things that I do to kind of hedge the bet as far as where, if it did go down, would I be able to survive it, things like that. But I think as far as safety goes, I feel safer flying across the ocean right now than I would driving my car in the snow up here in the mountains of Colorado, for sure.
I hear that one very loud and clear. Thank you. David Soucy, thank you so much for agreeing to be on El Paso Primetime. I wish we had more time to talk about this, and perhaps maybe at a later date we can sit down and actually pick this whole thing apart and be able to figure it all out together.
Well, I would really enjoy that. It's an honor being on your show, and hello to all the folks in Texas. I miss being down there.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for being with us. David Soucy is a CNN safe analyst. He's also the author of the new book, Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, Why It Disappeared and Why It's Only a Matter of Time Before This Happens Again. It's through Skyhorse Publishing. And congratulations once again on the book. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Well, here we are in the midst of spring break, and on the phone with me is probably, I would say, one of the best rising superstars in the business world today. Her name is Nicole Portwood. Nicole, welcome to El Paso Primetime.
Thank you, Dennis. It's such a pleasure to be here.
It's an honor to have you here because you and your husband have created such a wonderful pizza palace, so to speak, down in Austin. But more importantly, you're also the face, so to speak, one of two faces, really, with Tito's Handmade Vodka.
That is true. Yes, my husband and I opened our second location of our pizza place, so that's one baby. But the bigger baby certainly is my work as the vice president of marketing for Tito's Handmade Vodka. That's definitely what takes up more of my time.
How did you get, how did you get involved into the world of advertising? Didn't you at one time want to be an actress?
I did. I went to Southern Methodist University in Dallas, and I graduated with a degree in theater. Moved to New York, and I worked as an actor for about 6 months. Not very long, but long enough for me to really realize that is not what I wanted to do with my life. I had some short stints at a couple different magazines, and I ended up at a marketing firm doing media for Jack Daniels and then some other brands in that company, and I just absolutely fell in love with the distilled spirits business, and I've never looked back 16 years later.
You work with probably one of the most, I would say, probably one of the least recognizable and yet one of the most affable people in the business world. Together, you know, he's a very unique guy. Richard Branson is very unique. Steve Jobs, unique. Helen Gurley Brown, one of the most unique people out there. But Tito Beverage, the man behind the this small distillery that's been knocking it down, what's it like working for him?
Never a dull moment is absolutely the best way to describe it. Most people don't have the privilege of being able to work with the person who founded the company, whose vision is the underpinning of every decision that's made in the company. And it is at once liberating because of the trust that he puts in the people who work with him, and also very humbling because you're kind of the extension of this man's dream. He started this business with credit cards and the idea that he could do something better. No one would believe in him. No one put any money in when he, you know, did two rounds of investment. No one would support him. He has defied all laws of conventional wisdom, and somehow it has worked. He's a very dynamic individual. He's a thinker. He loves ideas. Kickstarter is like one of his favorite things of all time. He just likes to browse it and see what ideas are out there. So he's really captivated by this notion of human ingenuity, and obviously is, you know, someone who's capitalized on that to create something brand new, the micro distilling industry in this country, and an award-winning American vodka. Who knew, right?
Right, no kidding. And it's a wonderful vodka, too. One of the most unique things about this particular vodka is how smooth it really is.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a thing out there called Meet the Makers program. What's that all about?
One of the things that, you know, like I said, Tito's very into ideas, but he's also into entrepreneurialism and people who kind of take a right turn. They put their necks on the line for something that they believe in. So Meet the Makers is a program that we put together for 2015 to honor people who've done just that. They're artisans, craftspeople. All of them have come from different backgrounds, whether they were lawyers or doctors or, you know, people just working in banks. They had a passion, and they decided to leave behind a different life to pursue it, to put everything they had into it. Our first maker is a woman named Nicole Patel, who owns and is the main chocolatier for Delicia Chocolatier, based here in Austin. And she made these Tito's Handmade Vodka-infused truffles for us. It's a custom line that are only available in this limited quantity. We're selling them on our web store, and every penny is going back to Nicole to help support her business and hopefully, you know, gain her a little bit more exposure and help her take her business to the next level. It's really Tito's way of kind of giving back to this whole class of people who are creating themselves into white space and following their passions just as he did all those years ago.
This feels like it's a national program about to explode worldwide.
I certainly hope so. You know, we started it just as a small idea and thought it would stay in Texas. But it turns out, you know, that people from all over the country have heard about it and have started asking us how they can get involved. Our maker for second quarter this year is in North Carolina, and then we're talking to a guy in Kansas City. We've got people in San Francisco and New York and all over the country. So, you know, there's certainly a lot of energy for handcrafted products and for kind of understanding what's behind the making of things. I think we all get very personally invested when we know that there's a human being behind a product. It makes it mean more than just kind of buying something off the shelf that doesn't have a story to it.
To be honest with you, I've switched drinking vodkas over to Tito's because of several different options. Number one, it's Texas made.
Yes, indeed.
Okay. But more importantly, you know, it's supporting an entrepreneur. It's a micro-brewed liquor, and to me, you always support the underdog and then push the underdog to the forefront. So there's that level of that whole thing. And then the third part is, and what you and I have just been talking about, entrepreneurship. I mean, what better way to support somebody than to buy the product?
Absolutely. And I tell you from the bottom of my heart, thank you for it. We truly, truly appreciate your support of the brand. Every single person who buys a drink at a bar or a bottle at a liquor store means so much to us, because it is that bottle is the physical manifestation of something that this person has put their life into. You know, Tito came from a background of geology and geophysics. That's what his degrees are in. He was a seismic surveyor. He worked for oil companies. He worked in the mortgage business for a while, but never really found his path and his calling until he started making vodka. And I know that can sound a little strange, but, you know, it was the path that suited him, that allowed him to pursue something he was really, really passionate about, and against all odds, make it successful. So every person, every drink, every bottle is incredibly important to us. And I and Tito and all of us here, thank you very much.
Well, thank you for that as well. And what I'd like to also tell our listeners, like every responsible brewer does all over the world, always drink responsibly.
Yes. You know,
absolutely. You know, if you're going to imbibe, drink responsibly. Make sure that you have a designated driver. And if you don't have a designated driver, find one. Or, you know, find a taxi some way. But always drink responsibly. That's always the best thing. Which leads me to South by Southwest.
Here it comes.
Are you guys going to be out there?
We will, yeah. I mean, it's in our backyard, and Austin is such an important part of who we are as a brand. We'll do a couple of big things. We'll have a presence at the big outdoor stage that South by Southwest does down at Auditorium Shores, but our big thing is the bus that we man for the entirety of South by Southwest, building off of exactly what you were just talking about, which is responsible consumption and responsible driving. We offer it as a free service to all attendees of South by Southwest. It's a bus service that kind of makes the circuit of all the downtown venues that are hosting South by Southwest events. Like I said, it's free to jump on. We have a couple of different stops all throughout the city, and it's just another alternative. There are so many people here that a lot of the mass transit gets really clogged, and taxis are kind of hard to find. This is one thing we can do to kind of help promote responsible consumption and driving. We don't want anybody drinking and getting behind a wheel.
You know, one of the things that I'm noting about this conversation is the possibility of this extending nationwide, not only with the Meet the Makers program, which it already has, obviously, but this program as well. I can see it stretching into places where colleges and universities are going to be, where they have their own little celebrations. You know, coming around the corner is St. Patty's Day, mm-hmm. and you've got Easter, and you've got the spring breaks and everything and going on. I can see where other people will start getting on, no pun intended, the bandwagon and saying, you know what, let's offer this as well.
Yeah, we would love to see that. You know, we actually get outreach from quite a few organizations who are starting safe ride programs, especially in markets where there are a lot of institutions of higher learning, because there tends to be a larger concentration of young people. And those safe ride organizations and all the different platforms, whether it's an app that shows you every possible alternative transportation that's open to you, or, you know, the Ubers of the world, or just companies that are teams of people who are lobbying for additional mass transit within cities, those are all things that we wholeheartedly support. You know, distilled spirits are meant to be sort of celebration enhancers. They're social lubricants. They're things that are intended to help you have a great time. But, you know, abuse is a very serious thing, and drinking and driving is a very serious thing. So we are all about finding solutions for those things in the market.
Absolutely. And shows like El Paso Primetime, we try to illuminate that kind of thing as well. We understand that, you know, we're all adults here, mm-hmm. and we all understand that some people will excessively imbibe. We understand that. The history of jazz is rife with all of that. Heck, all of music is full of stories like that. However, there are those of us who say, look, just be responsible about what you do, and everybody will have a good time.
Exactly, exactly. Let's all be adults, and let's be safe about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Nicole, I'm sorry we've run out of time, but I certainly want you to come back to the program, because I really want to talk to you about your pizzas.
I would love to, Dennis. Thank you so much. I've had a wonderful time talking with you.
We've been talking to Nicole Portwood, Vice President of Marketing for Tito's Handmade Vodka out in Austin, Texas. And now, of course, drink responsibly. Have a great time at South by Southwest, and we'll be talking to you soon, Nicole.
Cheers.
Deidre Westenhauser is our producer for this episode of El Paso Primetime. We certainly thank you for listening. And we invite you to stick around for Louis Signs and Perspectives up next. Thanks for listening to El Paso Primetime.